This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello and welcome back to another live show on The People Speak. I am Sophia Rain, your host for the week. Today is Tuesday, September 5th. Tune in every Tuesday, 8 p.m. Central Time for live interview-style talk radio with various hosts and guests. Here on The People Speak, we encourage audience participation by phoning in questions or comments toll-free from Canada or the USA at 1-888-429-5471. For more information on upcoming shows, log on to bbsradio.com/thepeoplespeak. Here with me tonight is Barry Schwartz, an official documentary photographer for the Shroud of Turin Research Project, the team that conducted the first in-depth scientific examination of the Shroud in 1978. For those who might be unfamiliar with the Shroud, it's a cloth that is presumed to have been wrapped around the body of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Mr. Schwartz is here to discuss the Shroud's authenticity and how it's impacted his life over the years. Barry Schwartz, welcome back on The People Speak. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me on the show, Sophia.
Great. You know, I'm so excited. This is a great topic. It's one that we can actually go very deep into. But I want to start off, tell our audience, how a Jew boy like yourself got involved with the Shroud of Turin?
Yeah, it's kind of I'll try and keep it a short story, but I was a professional photographer and sort of specialized in scientific, medical, and technical things. And back in late 75, early 76, I was a consultant to Los Alamos National Laboratory as an imaging or photographic consultant on a project for the Los Alamos Labs. Of course, that had to do with atomic bombs, naturally. That's their product, if you will. And I completed that project, and about, I don't know, a few weeks after I finished, the gentleman I'd worked with, who was an imaging scientist, called me up again, and he asked me, hey, what do you know about the Shroud of Turin? And so I reminded him. I laughed, and I said, but Don, I'm Jewish. And Don laughed, and he said, so am I. Remember, he was one of the other Jewish guys on our team in the end. And so he asked me what I knew about it. I knew very little about it. I pretty much felt it was just another manufactured relic from the Middle Ages and didn't have much interest in it. So when he asked me, he told me they were going to form a team and that they would need a photographer. Was I interested? I said, no. And didn't feel. And he said, well, look, let me bring you some information on it first before you decide. Well, what he brought me was mainly a bunch of religious tracts that have been produced by the Holy Shroud Guild here in the U.S. that have been promoting the Shroud in America since the 50s. And so it didn't really help much. But in the end, I felt I was curious about one property of that image that they had visualized. And in the end, that's really what hooked me, was that unique property of the Shroud's image that encodes three-dimensional or depth or spatial information right into the density of the image. We can't do that with photography or with artworks. And so that caught my interest, and I ultimately stayed on the team. And 17 months or so later, went to Turin and spent 5 days and nights working around the clock, about 24 of us, and performed a complete set of non-destructive tests on the Shroud to try and determine how the image was formed. And so that, in a nutshell, is not only how I got involved, but the purpose of our team, which was to answer a single question: how is the image formed? Is it a painting? Is it an artwork of some sort? We weren't there to prove it was Jesus or not. We weren't there to prove the resurrection, as some people have said. We were there simply to characterize what was on this piece of cloth and how this image might have formed. And so that was our primary goal. And in the end, we came back proving it wasn't a painting or a photograph or a scorch, which were some of the properties that some skeptics had kind of voiced over those years. We came back proving it wasn't any of those things, but we knew of no mechanism that could make an image with these chemical and physical properties. So in essence, our simple goal was to answer one question. We came back with 1,000 new questions, but not an answer to the one that we went to ask. And we could tell you what it's not. It's not a painting, it's not a photograph, it's not a scorch. But as I said, we have no idea what mechanism can create an image with these specific chemical and physical properties. And we live in the most image-oriented era of human history. Right now, everybody's got a camera and a computer attached to it in their pockets. And yet modern science cannot create an image with these properties. That's just a statement of fact.
Can you tell the audience what your team did and how they brought this invisible man to life in front of your eyes through this photography?
Well, first of all, let's be clear that the image on the shroud isn't invisible. It's visible. It's very subtle. Mm-hmm. And the first photograph made in 1898 was the one that opened the door to science. Because before that, unless you'd gone to northern Italy, to Turin itself, on those rare occasions when it was publicly displayed, you didn't know anything about the shroud. Once the photographs were made and they discovered the negative property of the image, the lights and darks are reversed on the cloth the way a photo negative would be, they were then able to reproduce those photographs in books and other publications, and slowly but surely the word about the shroud started to spread because people could then see this amazing image on this amazing piece of cloth, and that sparked scientific interest for the first time. And of course, this was back in 1898 when the first photos were made, but it wasn't until 1978, 80 years later, before a real team of real scientists were given the opportunity to do an in-depth examination of the cloth. That's the first time that ever happened and the last time it ever happened. No one has been given that same permission since.
And that was way back before the 80s, right?
1978 is when we spent 5 days and nights examining it.
And so how was the church, what was the church like, you know, right after the examinations and all the testings? Were they upset? Did they make a fuss about how much was taken?
No, I mean, we didn't do it against their wishes, but the permission to examine the shroud didn't come from the church. It came from the then owner of the shroud, King Umberto, the deposed king of Italy. The Savoy family, his family, had owned the shroud for well over 500 years, and they were the legal owners of it, even though it was still in Turin, and the custodians were the Archdiocese of Turin. The ownership was clearly that of the Savoy family. It was King Umberto who gave our team permission to examine the shroud, so the church authorities, who were solely in those days the custodians, had to go along with the king's wishes and allow us to do the work. Had it been up to the church, I'm not convinced that they would have said yes to our proposal.
Yeah, but I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, but the king said yes, so the church didn't really have much of an option. They weren't happy, I can tell you, that there were a few people who were really upset about it over there.
I can imagine.
In Italy. But they had to grin and bear it because the king's word was absolute in that particular case. And so we were permitted to do our examination. And that, of course, is the first only in-depth exam that's ever been given. And that's 40 years ago now. So obviously it'd be nice to be able to take some 21st century technology and apply it to the shroud. And it's our hope that at some point in the not-too-distant future, the Turin authorities, the Pope, who is now the legal owner of it, will agree to allow another round of testing. Certainly not by the group of guys that I was a part of, because more than half of them have passed away now. But certainly some future group of younger people with modern technology might be able to answer some of the unanswered questions that remain, because we came back, like I said, with trying to answer a single question, but came back with 1,000 new questions on top of being unable to answer the one we went to ask.
Can you give us an idea of what questions, you know, that you would like 21st century technology to answer?
There isn't really a specific question, but a lot of questions. what people don't realize about the Shroud is what a complex subject it is. It deals with history and biblical history and theology and chemistry and physics and optics. So we have all these various disciplines that have an involvement in the study of the Shroud because it's unique. There isn't anything else like it in the world. And so it requires this, you know, forensic medical guys. We have all these different disciplines at play, and it makes for a much more complex subject than the average person would imagine. It really is really complex. So some of the questions that need to be answered, of course, one question is the chemical composition. We were using state-of-the-art technology circa 1978, but this is 2017, and the technologies, some new technologies exist that didn't even exist back then. Things that would allow us, for example, to point an instrument at the Shroud, and in that precise spot do total chemical analysis from the full spectrum, from infrared to ultraviolet, with one small instrument. Where in the past we had big instruments on big carts and tables and tripods and, you know, a lot of that could now be replaced with much more simpler and much more sophisticated technology. So the kinds of chemical analysis that we'd like to do in specific areas of the cloth could be accomplished using that technology without even touching the cloth. So there are some things that would be nice to apply, and there are many unanswered questions. Obviously, one of them is the age of the Shroud. Most listeners, if they know anything about the Shroud, will know that in 1988, a radiocarbon dating test was done of the Shroud, and they came up with a medieval date for it. And that was pretty much a shock to many of us who'd been studying the Shroud, because there's plenty of evidence, valid historical evidence, that it was around well before the earliest dates given by the carbon dating. So we knew there was something wrong with the carbon dating, but I'm a photographer, not a physicist. And I'm not able to challenge the physicists in their own protocols, but it turns out that there was really nothing wrong with the carbon dating except for one minor detail, the choice of the single sample that they selected from the Shroud. They took it from ostensibly the worst possible place, and they only took one, which means there was no point of comparison. You know, in science, if you're going to test a big piece of cloth and you're going to test its age, you take a sample from one corner, you take a sample from another corner, you take a sample from the side. You take more than one sample, so you have control samples. In the case of the Shroud, they took one sample, divided it in thirds, gave it to three labs, and even they didn't agree on the dates. They had a range of dates, but all of them said it was medieval. Well, it turns out that 12 years after the carbon dating, some researchers discovered that that particular corner of the cloth had been repaired. Not a visible repair the way we would expect a patch to look like, but a reweaving of the cloth because a piece had been cut from it right next to the sample site. When you cut a piece of cloth like that, it begins to unravel. So somebody rewove that little stretch, and that's the stretch of cloth adjacent to that seam that they took for carbon dating. The problem is they rewove it with newer materials, with medieval 16th century materials most likely, and consequently the date was skewed because there was newer material as part of the sample they tested. This has now been published in several peer-reviewed scientific journals, so the challenge to the radiocarbon dating is official, scientifically done in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. But, you know, the media still says, well, they proved it was a fake years ago. And now it took a dozen or more years before the media added. But they've now determined that the sample site they chose was wrong, so that date is no longer a valid date for the Shroud. So it becomes a question of, you know, how much science is going to be permitted? Will they permit more science in the future? Because right now we have had one taste 40 years ago, and it would be great to get another taste using more modern technologies and perhaps answer some of the unanswered questions that remain. The one big question is, how's that image formed? We still don't know a mechanism that can make an image like that.
For those who are now tuning in to the People Speak, I am Sophia Ray. We are here with Barry Schwartz, and we are discussing the Shroud of Turin. You know, how about the blood, Mr. Schwartz? What the amount of blood, wouldn't that help be able to form the image? And how about I'm just going to stick with that right now, the blood.
Okay, yeah, let me answer that. The blood and the image are two separate things on that cloth.
Okay.
The blood got on the cloth by direct contact with the body, by capillarity, just the way, if you were bleeding and we laid a sheet over you, the sheet would soak up some of your blood, and that's what happened with the shroud. That had nothing to do with the image. The image mechanism is separate from the blood and dramatically different, and does not constitute or is not created by the blood, nor necessarily by perspiration or other physical chemical reactions on the surface by something applied to it. Certainly no paint or pigments, no silver for photography, and no heating for the scorch effect that some people had suggested. So basically, going back, doing another set of tests would perhaps help us answer some of those questions.
So you see in this, excuse me, and witness this, in person. Now, something about the blood. Do you believe that there was a large amount of blood on there at one time, and therefore, because there is still a reddish tone of blood, is that correct? And that's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unusual for blood to stay red, and there's a number of reasons for that happening with the shroud in this case. But the blood in the image, I just wanted to be real clear, got on that cloth by two separate mechanisms. And interestingly enough, since we were talking about the blood, it was determined by our team that the blood was on the cloth before the image formed, and wherever there was blood, there's no image, which means that the blood somehow inhibited whatever that image formation mechanism was. So we do know that. But as far as the blood in general, I don't believe we're seeing as much blood as was on his body. Remember, blood dries and coagulates very quickly. And consequently, many people believe, not everybody, but many believe that they wiped his body with a wet cloth that would have re-wet the wounds, allowing the blood to transfer to the shroud. Because there was some time between taking him off the cross and getting him to the tomb and beginning to prepare the body for burial. And remember, it was also Friday afternoon, and they didn't have atomic clocks in those days, so sunset was the beginning of the Sabbath, so they had to stop before the sun went down. And the intent was obviously to come back the next day. But my belief is they most likely wiped his body just to get some of the dirt and stuff off of it, you know. I'm sure that if Mary was there, as I believe she was, she's a Jewish mother. She would have at least wiped his body, even if it violated Jewish law, which some people have said it might. I don't think that would have mattered to her at that moment in time. That was her child. So at any rate, we believe that the body would have had a lot more blood on it than is indicated by the shroud. But all the major wounds and all the scourge marks, over 120 of them from a Roman flagrum, are not only all over his back. You know, artists, typically when they depict the scourging of Jesus, they show his back all torn up by a whip.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're standing behind somebody with a whip and you're whipping them from behind, if you just take a baby step closer to that person, some of those thongs are going to come around, they're going to hit the front of the body as well. Now, that's not something an artist would have thought to do. We have scourge marks not only on his back, from his neck all the way to his ankles, but also on the front of his body, where the whipping, the lead weights on the leather thongs came around and actually hit the front of his body as well. And that's beyond what any artist has ever depicted. And it's actually far more forensically realistic and accurate than typical artworks of what was done to Jesus.
Before I lose this thought, I have to say it now, and I'm not trying to cut you off, but what we see in like pictures all over is Jesus nailed by the hands on a cross. But however, you don't see that on the shroud.
Well, no, actually, I want to qualify this. This has been a touchy subject for some of the forensic guys. What we see on the shroud is the back of one hand. We see an exit wound from the wrist nails or the hand nails. Now, based on where the exit wound is, and assuming that the Romans did their usual thing, all I can suggest is take your right hand and look at it, and put your thumb and your little finger together. Touch your thumb to your little finger and look at your palm. You notice that there's like two bulging sections with kind of a V or a groove running down the middle. It's called the thenar furrow. Now, if you're a Roman soldier and you got to nail somebody to a cross, you grab those two fingers, hold them, you've created a perfect spot to drive a nail. Now, if you open up your palm, you'll see that if you drove a nail there, it's only about an inch down from the center of the palm. It's still in the palm. But the exit wound comes out where exactly what we see on the shroud, which is a little closer to the wrist than one would have expected. And so the forensic accuracy of that wound is greater than any of the artistic depictions ever done. Because remember, none of the artists who depicted the crucifixion of Jesus were there witnessing the actual event to see how it was actually done. So there's something called artistic license. And artists have it. Mel Gibson used it when he showed Jesus scourged in his motion picture. He used hooks called scorpioni that the Romans did have, but it was capital punishment. If they used those on you, you weren't going to live to get on a cross. It would rip your flesh literally off the back, off your back. Mel used that because he wanted you to feel the horror as you sat in that darkened theater watching what was being done. He wanted to grab you and make you feel that horror. And so he used artistic license. The shroud is so accurate, it goes beyond any artistic interpretation of what was done to Jesus. And everything is forensically accurate according to the forensic experts. Not my field of expertise, but I worked with Dr. Zugabe and Dr. Bob Buckland, the guy they based the TV show Quincy on, and he was a member of our team. And these are the experts, and, you know, I have to rely on their expertise in these forensic things. But when they say that everything is 100% forensically accurate, they mean it. That's what they wouldn't say that if it weren't the case. So you have to take all that into account. And I think that's the problem with the shroud, that it's just not as simple as most people think it should be. Either it is or it isn't. Yeah, well, I agree. And I've got 40 years under my belt, and I still don't know the answer.
So, if you are just now tuning in to The People Speak, I'm Sophia Ray. We are talking and discussing the Shroud of Turin with Barry Schwartz here. Barry, I have to ask you this. This is kind of a question that I want to know, and I think the audience wants to know. Do you believe that shroud encapsulated in the body of Jesus of Nazareth?
Absolutely.
And what evidence have you discovered that compelled you to believe this? Because you're a scientific man. You're not a religious man. You're a Jewish man.
That's correct. You're
studying a huge topic of Christianity. Not only that, you have bridged it over, but I want to let you answer the question before I go further.
Well, look, I think that, first of all, the best answer I can give you is to share a little anecdote about my little Jewish mother, born in Poland, immigrated to America at age 7 as a child in 1930, the beginning of the Great Depression. She heard one of my lectures, and, you know, she wasn't highly educated, high school education. At the end of that lecture, she was silent. And when a Jewish mother's silent, be afraid, you know. It made me nervous that she wasn't saying anything. Finally, I had to ask her. We were driving back to her place, and I said, okay, what do you think? And she looked at me and said, well, of course, it's authentic. Now, this is a little Jewish lady, you know. Why? I said, Mother, what makes you say that? It took me 17 years to be convinced, and I had access to all the science. She hears one lecture, albeit from me, her son, but still, and she's automatically convinced. That was the last thing I expected from her, and her answer was very simple, straightforward, and brilliant, and an amazing observation. She said, Barry, they wouldn't have kept it for 2,000 years. If it belonged to anyone else, it wouldn't have mattered. And I kind of laughed when she said that until I thought about it and realized, first of all, this piece of cloth violates two Jewish laws. It has blood on it, so it's required to be buried with the body it wrapped. And two, it bears an image which is still forbidden by Jewish and the Muslim faith. So whoever rescued that couldn't come running out of the tomb saying, look what I found. Or somebody would have taken it, it would have been destroyed. They had to keep it a secret. So to put themselves at risk, why would they do that for Joe Blow, anybody, somebody of lesser importance? And so my mother's observation, as simple as it was, is really a profound one, because this is a burial shroud that somehow got separated from the body it wrapped. How does that happen? Where does that ever happen? And so, to me, there's, you know, I used to read a lot of Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, and he said, Doyle said out of the lips of Holmes, if you eliminate all the possibilities, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, is most likely the truth. Well, when you eliminate all the possibilities, the only one left for me, and it took 17 years to reach that conclusion, was that this has to be the burial shroud of Jesus of Nazareth. That's the most logical, plausible explanation. Everything else, some medieval guy inventing photography, inventing a means of creating an image that modern science can't duplicate, that's what the skeptics want us to believe. And I just don't see that. And I personally believe that this cloth wrapped his body. And that's, you know, it, putting aside the religious overtones, just as a human being, just as a historical figure, why is it so hard to accept that we might have an artifact of this man whose life is probably more, has touched more people on this planet than any other living person or person who's ever lived? Why shouldn't we have an artifact of his? Why shouldn't that have been preserved? To me, it's logical that it would have been. And his disciples believed, many of them, that he was the Messiah. They would have treasured this and secreted it away and kept it hidden and preserved it. And it's, you know, it's left, and here it is today, and we still don't have an answer to it. So I don't have a problem saying that I believe this is the cloth that wrapped Jesus of Nazareth. That's not really a religious statement. That was it. He was a historic figure.
Absolutely. I'm not quite sure if I'm convinced yet. I want to be, but I don't know. How long did it take you to get convinced? You know, at first you were not a believer, and I'm the
type that... Well, I'm still not a believer in the Christian sense.
Okay.
Just to be clear on that, I'm still Jewish, not a Messianic Jew. So, but I have to add this right at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. People frequently evangelize me, and I consider that an expression of love. People want me to feel in my heart what they feel in theirs. So when somebody evangelizes me, I accept that as I take it as a compliment and as a gift. But this isn't about me. My involvement with the shroud is simply to bring this information to the public. So it doesn't really matter what I think. What really matters is that you have access to what we know about it, so you can decide for yourself what you think. And I think that's the important part of the shroud. Frankly, I'm not sure the shroud is there to answer our questions, but maybe it's there to make us ask the questions, because it certainly forced me over the years to, I had to confront my own beliefs, because people were asking me and I didn't even know what I believed. And it forced me to confront my faith for the first time as an adult. I was in my 50s. And it was a good thing that it happened, because it brought me back to my faith in God. And how many Jews can say it was the Shroud of Turin that did that? Not many. And so I feel very grateful, because I was raised in an Orthodox home. It was, my grandparents lived with us. My parents both from Poland. So, you know, I was first generation here. It was a real immigrant family. And God was part of everything every day. My grandparents lived with us. My grandfather got up and did the morning prayers every day, and they lit the candles and did all the things, two sets of dishes, two sets of silverware, all of the things, traditional things of an Orthodox Jewish home. So God was part of everything every day. But I didn't make that connection until I was in my 50s, and I stopped looking outside and started looking within myself and found God had been there all along. And it was the shroud that led me on that path to sort of search within myself. And I remember saying that to a priest one day, and he just smiled and said, that's exactly what Jesus said, the kingdom of God is within us. Well, that's where I found God. I didn't find him in a church or a synagogue. That's me. I can't say that would be appropriate for anybody else. But for me, it was my looking within myself, trying to figure out what I believe so I could answer the questions like the ones you've asked me as honestly as possible. I had to know, and I didn't know what I believed at that point, but that was 20-some years ago. Now I consider myself a person of faith, And I thank the Shroud for sort of leading me back to that part of my life that really hadn't been there for a long time. So I can say that now it's not the same experience that a Christian might have in exploring the Shroud. But you mentioned a word a moment ago, and I'm going to tell you something. You said you're not yet convinced. It's not my place to convince people. Now, when I first started doing this, I probably tried. But I learned over time that that was a mistake on my part. The best thing I could do is offer access to all the information that we have and tell people, you have to make up your own mind about this. A guy came up to me after one of my lectures, said, great lecture, but you'll never convince me. And my answer was, what makes you think I care what you believe? That's between you and God. Take it up with him. That's what I told the guy. And he smiled. He thought that was a good answer. But as far as my faith goes, my faith is in God. I am deep in my faith now, and I can say that it was because of the Shroud that I was brought back to that point of my life. But, you know, what my beliefs are really aren't that critical to the work that I've done with the Shroud. It isn't about me. It's about this piece of cloth and what we know about it. And I've spent now over almost 22 years building that website into something that will hopefully stand the test of time and be a place where future researchers can come and find what they're looking for in one place. And
let's give that website
the hard
out.
Work that our team did. You know, we did a lot of hard work over a long time, and that needed to be preserved, and it is on the website.
And the website is shroud.com, and that's the website you talk about, right?
That is correct, shroud.com.
Barry, and, I hate to cut you off, but we got to take this into a break. Let's hold this thoughts. When we come back, I want to talk to you about making other bridges. You've been crossing cultural barriers here through religion. Let's talk a little bit more about this, and we'll be right back just in a few minutes. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be back with Barry Schwartz in just a few moments.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
And we are back on The People Speak with Barry Schwartz. I am your host, Sophia Ray. We were leading into break just a little bit roughly, but Barry, we were talking about my belief, or I'm not there to make people believe, and I respect that. I highly, highly respect that. You found your way, and that's great. A lot of people, they have trouble. But Barry, I want to talk about what you recently have done, and I was reading, doing some research on you, and you were speaking out to Muslims about the Shroud, and that's something interesting.
Yeah, about 3 years ago, well, let me backtrack. First of all, about 10 years ago, I was contacted by a publication in London called the Review of Religions. They're a Muslim publication published by the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, that are not the mainstream Muslims that have been killing each other for 1,000 years. They're the newest sect of the Islamic faith. And they have their motto is love for all, hatred for none, and they live that. So they're called heretics by the mainstream Muslims because they practice peace, which is kind of funny. At any rate, 10 years ago or so, they contacted me and wanted to reprint one of my articles about the Shroud. So I said, sure, no problem, and they did. Since then, they've done that 3 or 4 more times, and back in May of 2015, because the Shroud was going on public display that year, they devoted an entire issue of the publication to the Shroud, my articles, dozens of my photographs, and it was such a success that their spiritual leader would be the equivalent of the Pope for a Catholic, suggested that they contact me to come and speak at their annual event in England called the Jalsa Salana, to speak and address them about the Shroud. Well, I was a little apprehensive, needless to say. I'm a Jewish guy discussing a Christian relic, and I'm invited to a Muslim convention. That gave me some pause for a moment or two. But I also realized something else, that these were not the Muslims that we read about in the newspaper. I did some homework to find out who they were and whether it would be wise for me to accept or not their invitation. Well, it turns out that I did accept their invitation. I went, and I stood in front of the biggest audience I've ever addressed in person, 35,000 people.
Ooh.
And I had nothing prepared for that part of it. I was giving Shroud lectures in a smaller venue at the event, but not in the main tent where there were more than 10,000 people sitting right in front of me, and another 25,000 watching in other tents and big monitors all around the event, and around the world, technically, on their network. They have a MTA network, which goes to 150 million people. And I stood in front of this group, and I told them the truth. I said, well, I was a little nervous about coming here because you invited a Jewish guy to discuss a Christian relic at a Muslim convention. But I saw this as God opening a door, that I should go through this door, and I should go and meet these people. And sure, we have differences. That's easy to find. But it's obvious that there's something we have in common, and we should use that as something to at least foster some dialogue. Well, this year, I was back for the third year in a row, and their spiritual leader invited me back personally again next year. So I'll be back for the fourth year next time. And we've expanded it. I brought in some European Shroud scholars and experts. I wanted them to see who this group was. So I brought in one gentleman from Turin and one from Spain, from Oviedo, Spain, where the Sudarium of Oviedo is kept, and an expert on that. And we've grown this into something, and I'm now part of their committee to expand their information about the Shroud to their 150 million and growing every year community. Now, they're not going to change their points of view. They believe the Shroud proved Jesus was alive. And so I don't believe in patronizing anybody, so I get up in front of them and say, look, I've worked with the forensic experts that I've known, and they say he was dead. They're well qualified to have that opinion. I'm not. I have to go with what they say. But I do point out that how the exact same evidence, because there are some forensic pathologists who look at the Shroud and say he was alive. There are some out there. And consequently, I point out that this is one of the limitations of science, because the same exact evidence is interpreted 180 degrees differently by two different groups based on their own personal perspectives. This is one of the limits of science. Human beings are involved, you know, and some things have to be interpreted, and that interpretation can be influenced by who we are, what our background is, what our perspective is on things. And so rather than challenge them, they're not going to change because I suggested it, and it's not my place to challenge their beliefs. My goal is to educate them on what we know about this piece of cloth. And so to that end, it's been a great success. And this year it was 40,000, and I was on live on TV. They put me on every year for a 30-minute live TV show. And that goes out to 150 million people. So I'm probably better known now in the Ahmadiyya Muslim world than I am in the Christian world. It's kind of ironic. But I'll tell you something. They live their faith in every facet of their lives just the way Orthodox Jews and good Christians do. They live their beliefs, and they are peace-loving, wonderful folks, just like you and I. And so I'm grateful that I was given this opportunity to go and find out for myself. and be enlightened, because I didn't know anything about Muslims, and here in the U.S. we don't really hear any of the good news. Mm-hmm. You know, matter of fact, that was one of the quotes. You can find it on YouTube, my little 3.5-minute speech. I said, I think in closing, in America we only hear bad news about Muslims, and I pointed to 10,000 men sitting in front of me, and I said, you are the good news. And that's the quote you'll find on YouTube. But
wow.
That little speech is there, and it's true that we don't hear about them, because things that are about love and peace and good things, that's not what our newspapers and news reporters want to report. They only want to report horrible things and terrible things and fearful things. And I don't want to get into a whole thing about the media, but the point is, I'm glad I went and saw for myself. And interestingly enough, I was interviewed this time for the first time ever by the London Jewish Chronicle. And I was thinking, well, when this lady gets here, the first question is going to be, what the heck are you doing here? But that wasn't the case at all. She immediately realized what this was, that this was Christians and Jews and Muslims coming together to have a discourse about a piece of cloth that's relevant to many of those people of faith. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's amazing that there wasn't more news coverage. This is from a Jewish lady. So she recognized what I recognized, that this group doesn't get any media coverage because they're not doing anything frightening and terrible and horrible. They're living peaceful lives. They don't allow any terrorists or any, you know, jihadists into their mosques. And so, and I've now been with them 3 years in a row, and I got to tell you, I get treated so well there, it spoils me. They take such good care of me. And I asked them the first year, I said, why is everybody kind of fawning over me and making sure I have everything I need? And the answer is simple, because you're our guest. Now, that's the way my grandmother raised us, you know, that when you have a guest, they get everything first. You treat them with the greatest respect. And that's the way they treat me when I'm there. And not just me, but everybody.
That was the American way, too, with the First Nations. You know, they did that with, you know, when the foreigners came from overseas, they treated them well, like guests.
Yeah.
I, you know, gave them food and shelter. This is going to lead me into my next question here about, I want to know, did they express anything to you that maybe perhaps they might have some belief that whoever's in that shroud might have been somebody Muslim?
Well, they, you know, they view Jesus as a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
He is mentioned, I'm not an expert on the Quran, but he's mentioned throughout the Quran. And they call him Isa.
Yeah,
but
that's correct.
It's Jesus. That's who they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if it's Arabic or Urdu or whatever the language is. But and so they respect him and love him as a prophet. They don't see him the way a Christian does, obviously. But the fact that they view this shroud as something important, even if it's the opposite point of view that you and I might have, They show love and respect for this piece of cloth just the way I do and all of my Christian brothers and sisters do. And for that, you know, you can't fault them for that. That's a step in the right direction to have an open dialogue, to be able to discuss these issues and even debate them. And just because it comes up every year that I'm there that they believe he was alive, I believe he was dead. And like I said, you know, best that I can do is point out that the same data is available to everybody. You interpret it the way you want to. That's the limitation of human science. Human beings are involved, and we are susceptible to our own personal beliefs. It's hard to separate those from everything you do. So I can understand their point of view. And look, I've spoken not just to the Muslim communities, but to the Orthodox Christian community. To the Protestant community, from evangelicals and non-denominational Christians to Methodists and Lutherans and Baptists. And so I'm a sort of an equal opportunity speaker. I'll talk to anybody that wants to listen, pretty much. And the beauty of that is that I think that there were many Christians, certainly here in the U.S., that looked at the shroud and went, that's just a Catholic thing. Well, Yeah, technically that's correct now, but only since 1985. Before that, it was owned by in the private hands of the Savoy family. So it's never really been a, quote, Catholic thing until 85, if you want to start counting them. But that's not very long in the age of a 2,000-year-old cloth. So there are many kind of misconceptions that many Christians have had about the shroud. You know, one of the best examples is, oh, well, he's got long hair. It says in the Gospels, long hair is forbidden. Paul wrote that in Corinthians. And I said, yeah, when did he write that? How about 20 years after Jesus was crucified? Those were new rules from the new church that had no bearing on Jesus' life, who followed the laws of Moses, which forbids men to trim their beards and sidelocks and hair. And go to any Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Jewish community to see all the men have beards and long hair and sidelocks. Because it was
forbidden. That was a question I was going to ask. How long was men's hair during the time of Jesus Christ? I saw that on your the shroud.com.
It varied. There were men that had shorter hair. Uh-huh. But the Orthodox Jews all had beards. All the prophets, all of the, you know, the old-timers, they all had beards. And I'm certain that Jesus and most of his disciples had beards because that was what the laws of Moses required. So the fact that he happened to have long hair and Paul was sort of critical of that in Corinthians, I've read it and I saw what it said, that didn't apply to Jesus. That was 20 years later. So Jesus just followed the laws of Moses. The New Testament hadn't been written yet. So he couldn't follow any rules from the New Testament that they hadn't been put down yet. And so that's one of the common kind of fallacies that many Christians have about the shroud. This oil can't be real because it's got long hair. Well, you know, and the other thing is it says there's two cloths in the Gospels. It says there was a second cloth folded and separate from the other. That, you know what that tells me? Authentic Jewish burial, because that second cloth was the one they covered his face and the head with, and they took him off the cross. It had blood and pleural fluids on it from his lungs. It still exists in Spain today. And because of that, Jewish law says it must be buried with the body. So when I read that passage in the New Testament, I said, well, this is an authentic Jewish burial. Or that second cloth wouldn't have mattered at all. Only to a Jew of the first century, would that have been critical? And yet it was there. So, you know, just because there were two cloths and they may have gotten separated over 2,000 years, the sudarium still exists. It's in Oviedo, Spain. I've seen it. And it doesn't have any image on it. It was just put on his face and head to bring him from the cross to the tomb, and then it was taken off, folded up, and set aside to be buried with the body. And that's very consistent with Jewish law.
Isn't that a codex of some sort, a praying codex, the way that they wrap this body up?
Codex. It's a Hungarian illuminated manuscript, just a small manuscript.
Uh-huh.
But it was illuminated, and the pray codex is very important because it was done around 1191. That's about 70 years earlier than the earliest possible date given by the carbon dating guys. Well, in that illuminated manuscript is an illustration of the shroud being wrapped on Jesus's body, no thumbs visible, spear wound in the side. The artist tried to simulate the herringbone zigzag weave of the, you know, that type of woven cloth that the shroud is made of. And there's some burn holes in the shroud that predate the big fire that caused all the visible damage. Those burn holes were from an event that was undocumented. We don't know when or where it occurred. But they were there long before the 1532 fire that caused all the major damage. We know that because the guy who illuminated the Prey manuscript included the L-shaped burn holes in his rendition of the shroud. So there's evidence that he had obviously seen the shroud and used that as a reference for his illuminated manuscript, and that was 70 years earlier than the earliest possible date given by the carbon dating guide. So we knew right off the bat that just by the Prey Codex alone, there's strong historical evidence that the shroud existed well before the earliest date given by the carbon dating guide. And that's just one piece of the evidence. There's others. But that is a very significant one, yes.
We're going to be coming to the very close to the end of the show. And before we do, I want to ask just a couple more questions if I can. I don't want to cut you off. But
no, that's okay.
Was there DNA testing on the shroud itself, and what did it reveal?
Yes, there was one credible DNA test that was performed in 1995, University of Texas Health Science Center. Although the sample that they tested was never authorized by Turin to be used for DNA analysis. But it was used, the results were released, and Turin demanded the return of the sample, which is a pretty good indication that the sample they had was authentic. Or why would they ask for its return? At any rate, what that DNA analysis showed was male, human, normal chromosomes, no weird chromosome thing, and that the DNA segments were far too degraded for a profile to be obtained, which would make it impossible for any kind of cloning to ever be done, because you need a complete DNA profile. And there is no such available from the shroud because it's too old and degraded. And look, old DNA degrades, and remember, they used to hang the shroud out on balconies to display it, so there was plenty of opportunity for it to become contaminated and degraded. And that brings me to the other issue, which is the contamination factor. Excuse me. Everybody who's touched that cloth, leaned over that cloth, worked on that cloth, repaired that cloth, prayed over it, cried over it, touched it, we've all left our DNA on there. Even mine. So I'm another long-haired Jewish guy whose DNA is on that cloth. And so the biggest problem is this. There's not going to be anything clonable because you don't know who you're cloning. And remember that DNA analysis is comparative analysis in the first place. And so does anybody have Jesus's DNA profile that we can compare to? Well, the answer, of course, is no.
Right.
And because of that, we don't believe that DNA analysis is going to be very helpful in analyzing the shroud because of the limitations we have of both contamination and the fact that the original stuff that's on there has been there for a couple thousand years, so it's very degraded.
I want to ask something that's going to maybe take a little more of a here's the question. Is it a possibility that the shroud is a product of religious propaganda elaborately planned out by the most brilliant mind or minds of its speculated date of origin?
I'm laughing because I almost know the skeptic you're quoting there, I think.
Actually, I came up with that myself, so.
that's exactly almost verbatim what some of the skeptics have said. There's no evidence to support that. I mean, sure, they made a lot of relics back in the day. There's no doubt about it. That's one of the reasons that I expected this was a fake at the very beginning of it all. But in the end, I just don't believe that that there's anybody. To accept that, I have to believe that some medieval artist created an artwork without any artistic implements or paints or pigments, that only touched and discolored and yellowed the top surface of the top fibrils.
Whoa.
2 microns deep. Now you tell me some medieval guy conceived them.
What if some medieval man had just crucified another man? Maybe, I don't know, what was the height of men during this time?
It varied. They found the remains of first century Jews over 6 feet.
I mean, they could have wrapped somebody up about the man's height and said, hey, this is Jesus.
Okay, how'd they make the image? How'd they make the image?
The same way, exactly. I have no idea. I'm not the expert here.
See, that's the catch. We can't duplicate the image today. So The skeptics want me to accept that some medieval guy not only figured out a way to do this, but he only did it once. He never did it a second time. He made this amazing image that encoded three-dimensional information into the density of the image, which is what we have on the shroud. And he made one and stopped. And that's the one we have now. Look, if somebody had actually created a technique for making images like this back in the medieval times, there'd be lots of them. And somebody would have gotten very wealthy making these images. No, look, there's just no way that this was created by the hand of a man. This is not a manufactured image. The cloth is manufactured, probably in Syria, but that's it. The image, it didn't come with the image on it. That image got on the cloth somehow. And I'm not any closer today to an answer than I was 40 years ago, except that I can tell you now that it's not a painting, not a scorch, and not a photograph. I can tell you that.
You know, before you leave this place, you know, is it on your bucket list to get an answer? Will you propose more testing to be done on the shroud in this near future? Will you leave this show and tomorrow propose more testing?
Well, I'm not in a position to propose anything as far as more testing. Remember, I'm not a scientist. I'm an old hippie photographer, okay?
But you have some experience with it.
Yeah, about 40 years with the shroud and about, 50 years in the sciences, even though I was not. My degree isn't in science. Most of my degree was science, and I've worked with scientists and researchers throughout my entire career. But I don't think that I'll be proposing anything. However, I have written editorials proposing future testing, but not that I be a part of it or that I recommend what tests to be done. That's left the smarter guys than me, the real scientists out there. They can do that. My job would be simply to report that, to collect the data, to make it available to the public so that whatever new information we might get would be available to everybody.
This is the time where I have to say this is the end of the show. Is there a website that you can give our listeners that where they can maybe go and get in contact with you or know more about the Shroud? Is it shroud.com?
Shroud.com. It's as simple as that. People always ask me how I got the name. In 1995, it was available.
All right. I want to give a huge thanks to our guest, Barry Schwartz. Check out his website at shroud.com. Big thanks to our engineer, I believe, Sean. Thank you, Sean. And our producer, Mike Kim. Be part of the change for a better of our planet. Let us unite through love and light. Be safe and good to one another. Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.